Blood on the River by Alyssa Carbon, Chapter 8, page 52. The 6th and 20th day of April, about 4 o'clock in the morning, we descried the land of Virginia. Master George Percy, observations. The tween deck seems dark after all those sunlit days on the island. We are sailing north now, toward Virginia. Reverend Hunt says we will travel right past Florida without stopping, because it belongs to the Spanish. He says that 40 years ago the French had a colony at Fort Caroline in Florida. He tells me how he heard that the Spanish came and massacred all the French settlers, men, women, and children. No, we will not be foolish enough to land at Florida. Foul weather makes the tween deck even darker. Thunder cracks, loud as a cannon shot. I look up through, page 53, the hatch opening and see black storm clouds boiling in the sky. Take in the sails, Captain Newport orders. Another crack of thunder booms and lightning flashes. I hear the wind whip the rigging against the masts. The sea bucks and the ship rolls and jerks. Men begin to retch as if they were new to seafaring. The rain comes down in torrents, and when we shout that it is flooding the tween deck, the sailors oblige us by covering up the hatch so we are shut in the dark with only stale, vomit-scented air to breathe. Lanterns are lit, and they swing wildly, making shadows move like ghostly dancers. The gentlemen complain bitterly. We should go back to England, they say. We should have reached Virginia weeks ago. We must be off course. This voyage is ill-fated. I lie in my bed, angry and discouraged. Captain Newport has been telling us for weeks that we'll see land any day. Maybe we are off course. I am sick of the tween deck, sick of sailing, sick of the storms that have come, one after another. And this is the most violent storm yet. The sound of crashing waves is a roar in my ears, punctuated by the creaking of the wooden ship. James and Richard lie next to me. Are we going to die? James asks. Will the waves break open the hull? I hear a loud crack and it makes me jump. It is followed by frantic squawking, and I realize it is only a, page 54, chicken crate that is smashed into an ale barrel down below. Shut up, James, I snap at him. I am annoyed that he could scare me into mistaking a sliding chicken crate for a cracking ship's hull. Yes, you are going to die. Every one of us is going to die, I say. James began to whimper, and I am sure he's dripping snot onto the bed. Aw, do you want your stepmom now? I taunt him. Richard sits up and slugs me in the arm. Stop it, he shouts over another rumble of thunder. Leave him be, you stinking jail rat. You're nothing but a common thief. In a second, I'm up on my knees. I'm pounding Richard with my fists, punching his face, his shoulders, anywhere I can hit. He is kicking, flailing. He kicks me in the stomach, and I can't breathe. James scoots out of our way and wails for Reverend Hunt. In the shifting shadows, it's hard to see. I swing. My first connects with Richard's teeth. I feel my knuckles cut open. Now Richard is on his feet. He whacks me on the side of my head. I feel dizzy, but I jump up, ready to meet him toe to toe. Strong arms close around my chest, dragging me back away. I see Richard's face, blood dripping from his mouth down his chin. It is not Reverend Hunt who has dragged me away. I will not get a sermon on how fighting is not the Lord's way, how I must learn to act from love instead of anger. No, it is Captain Smith who has hold of me. I know better than to struggle. He drags me to where the chain bolts lie, then releases me. Stand on one foot, he orders. I hesitate a moment, thinking this is a stupid thing he has ordered me to do. He cuffs me for my hesitation. It is the first time he has hit me, and it makes me want to run. But there is no place to run to. Stand on one foot, he shouts. I can do this ridiculous thing or be cuffed again harder, but it is difficult to balance on the rocking ship, but I try. I lift my left leg, balance on my right. The ship lurches. I stumble, catch myself. I try again, fall against a barrel. Do it! Captain Smith orders. He is glowering at me. Stand on one foot, you fool! Tears catch in my throat. He is worse than my father. I lift one leg. I balance for a split second. But Captain Smith shoves me, and I fall onto the tween deck floor. I shout in frustration. He stands over me. Does it work, Samuel? He demands. Can you stand on one foot when a storm rocks the ship? Can you keep your footing when I shove you? I am bewildered and angry. I shake my head. No, I cannot balance on one leg in a storm. Captain Smith picks up the chains that recently held him prisoner. In London, it might have worked for you. Page 56. The standing on your own, treating other boys as if they don't matter. In Virginia, it will not work. Do you understand me? The wilderness is like a ship in a storm. We will need one another to survive. He clamps the irons roughly around my ankles and wrists. If these blasted gentlemen refuse to learn that fact, then at least my page will learn. Learn it. This colony will need to stand on many legs if we are not to be toppled over in the Virginia wilderness. He goes back to his own bed, and I am left to try to find a comfortable way to sleep in my chains between two crates. Land ho! The shout comes before dawn. It is followed by a loud ruckus up on deck, whooping and hollering, laughing and stomping. Everyone on the tween deck is awake in an instant. Captain Smith calls across to Reverend Hunt. "Reverend, did you pray up that storm last night? From the sounds of it, it blew us straight to Virginia. I am cold and stiff from sleeping, chained, curled up in a small space like a snail. I rub my eyes. My head hurts. My jaw aches. I need a slop bucket badly, and there is none within reach. I am too proud to call for it, though, so I grit my teeth and wait." Someone lights a lantern and men begin to stir. Page 57. Someone lights a lantern and men begin to stir. Reverend Hunt marches Richard over to me. His cheek is swollen. One of his eyes is turning purple. I am proud of my handiwork. Richard looks at me. I see a half-smile cross his face. I realize I must be purple and swollen, too, for him to look so satisfied. Reverend Hunt clears his throat. "Richard has something to say," he tells me. Richard twists his shirt tail around his fingers. "I'm sorry I hit you," he said quickly, "and I won't call you those bad names anymore." I wonder if he means it, or if he's just obeying Reverend Hunt. But mostly, I am hoping someone will figure out that I need a slop bucket before I soil my slops. Captain Smith ambles over. "As I remember it, it was important for someone to bring me a bucket in the morning when I was locked in those things," he says, and yawns. "But Samuel doesn't need anyone's help, so I suppose we'll just leave him be. That's the way he likes it." The three of them start to walk away. I am about to burst. I jump to my feet. "Captain Smith, sir," I call after him. "Might I please have a slop bucket?" Captain Smith looks at me and laughs. "Me? An officer? Serving my own page? I think not." I dance from one foot to another. Why is he tormenting me? I certainly can't ask Reverend Hunt to bring it. Page 58 to me. Then I understand. Richard is the only one I can ask, the only one who should be asked to bring the slop bucket to another servant. I groan. I can't wait much longer. I'll be embarrassed beyond words, and have no clean slops to wear. "Richard," I try to keep the desperation out of my voice. "I am sorry for punching you last night. Bring me a bucket, would you?" Richard glances at Captain Smith and grins, enjoying his moment of victory. But Captain Smith puts a quick stop to the gloating. "Don't make the boy wait. Hop to it," he says. The moment Richard sets the bucket down, I drop my slops, have a seat, and relieve myself. Captain Smith seems satisfied with what I have learned about cooperation, and he unclamps my chains. "Don't let your anger get the best of you, Samuel," he says. "Learn to channel it, and it will become your strength rather than your weakness." I have seen that he has been channeling his anger at Master Wingfield and Captain Ratcliffe into his writing. He is telling his side of the story. I turn my attention to the excitement at hand. Have we really found Virginia? Master Wingfield pounds on the closed hatch. "I demand to know what is happening up there," he shouts. Finally, the sailors pull open the hatch and send down reports. "We have entered a bay. There are tall trees along a sandy shoreline. There is no sign of savages." Then they, page 59, tell us we're dropping anchor. A party will go ashore to explore. At last we are allowed up on deck for our first sight of Virginia. It is green, quiet, and desolate. There are no natives coming to us in canoes as they did in the Caribbean islands. There are no houses, no huts, just wise old trees and spring leaf standing guard over the sandy shore. Quiet, desolate, and free. We can pick any place, any piece of forest or meadow, and make it ours. A group of gentlemen and sailors get ready to go ashore. "Bring picks and shovels," Master Wingfield orders. Captain Smith scoffs. "I suggest we find a place to live before you go digging for gold. We can't eat gold." Master Wingfield gives him a disdainful look. "Did you not read your contract with the Virginia Company? The part where it says we are to turn a profit for the company as soon as possible? We will eat the supplies we brought and dig for gold." The Godspeed and Discovery are anchored nearby as well. I watch as the longboats are rowed to shore. About 30 men in all disembark for the exploratory trip, most of them gentlemen and sailors. Many of them have their muskets ready, with slow matches burning. Those of us who are left spend the day sitting or lying around either on the deck or in the tween deck waiting. And while we wait, the gentlemen, soldiers, carpenters, page 60, laborers and servants all discuss their ideas about the new world. "You can't get gold in a day. We'll need to plow and plant and live here a while." "You won't catch me walking behind a plow. I've got peasants to do that back in England. I say we eat the stores we've brought, get the gold fast, and go home." "The gold is not where the biggest profit is. I want to explore, find the new passage to the Orient the Virginia Company wants. Now that's how to strike it rich. If we can get goods, silk, spices, and jewels from India and China back to England without having to deal with those Ottoman Turks and their marked-up prices, just think of the profits we will make." And there is one lone voice, Reverend Hunt, who says he has not come for gold or to find the new passage to the Orient. He says we have been sent by God for more noble purposes, to bring the good news of Christ to the Virginia natives, and to look for survivors from the Roanoke colony. Of course, as soon as he says it, all the other men agree that that's some of why they have come as well. But I know their hearts are more set on gold and profits than finding lost colonists or saving souls. James and Richard have gotten hold of a deck of cards and are playing and laughing. I am determined to stay out of trouble, so I don't say one mean thing to them all day. When I look at the quiet forest, I wonder what it will be, page 61, like to live there, to build houses and create a settlement. I wonder what it will be like to do as Captain Smith says and work with the others, rather than keeping to myself the way I have done for so long. It seems to me that it will be strange, and I'm not sure how I will like it. The cook starts supper. He throws a large chunk of pork and several pounds of peas with water into the cook pot. Later he adds handfuls of sea biscuits. They are hard enough to break your teeth when they are dry, but in the peas porridge they become soft and chewy. At dusk we hear voices and look out to see the men returning. They are in good spirits, and I wonder if they found gold already. Just in time for supper, declares the cook, and he begins to ladle peas porridge into the mess pots. Suddenly I hear a cry, then frantic shouting and someone moaning. I run to the railing. In the half-light of dusk I see them, five of them, crouched on a hill, their naked bodies painted, arrows flying from their longbows. Already one of the sailors has fallen. No! I shout as my objection can change anything. Use your muskets! Shoot them! I hear the command. Make ready your piece! Our men load the muskets, prime the pan, charge the piece with powder, put the musket ball, ram down the charge, and cock the match. But by the time the first musket shots ring out, page 62, Indians are already leaving, creeping away silently on hands and feet like bears. The musket balls don't even come close to them. The injured men are brought to Dr. Thomas Wooten aboard the Godspeed. A gentleman, Gabriel Archer, has been shot through both hands, and a sailor has been shot twice in the torso. I see now that this land is not so free and open. This is Indian land, and they do not want us here. And what is worse, it seems to me that their bows and arrows are quicker, more accurate, and can shoot farther than our muskets.